There's a well-known term in Latin, tabula rasa, and it means clean slate. So as they would write on these pieces of slate, you could wipe it clean and you could just start over again. It's tempting to apply that to the world after the flood, but it's probably not right. We don't know precisely the population of the earth prior to the flood, but it's likely higher than you think. The catastrophic consequences of the flood likely resulted in the death of many hundreds of millions of people. Earth appears to have been wiped clean from the pervasiveness of sin, but was it really? Remember, sin is inward. It's in our hearts by nature. And so when the world population is reduced from many hundreds of millions down to 8 living souls of Noah's family, it might appear that the world has a clean slate. Genesis 8 records Noah disembarking from the ark, and he builds an altar, and he offers an acceptable sacrifice to the Lord. And nobody gets jealous and murders him, so it looks like we're making progress. Much of the account is reminiscent of the Garden of Eden. God commands them to multiply and to cover the earth, and he gives them rules, and he gives them dominion over the living creatures of the earth. And he says, "I'll establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you." Unfortunately, that's not all that mirrors the Garden of Eden story. Just like the creation account is followed by the fall, Genesis 9 shows the failure of Noah and his family. Right away, Genesis 9, starting in verse 20, describes Noah planting a vineyard and making wine and getting pass out drunk. And when you read what follows, you're left either wondering about more information or feeling like you've got more information than you wanted. Noah's son Ham enters his tent where his father is naked, and it's an ugly story. The earth may have been washed clean, but the sin in man's heart is still there. Now, one other thing mirrors the creation and fall accounts. After the failure, there's a curse, and within that curse, there's going to be a promise. So, what happens in Genesis 9 is tradition dictates Noah looks at to his sons to give them a blessing or a curse, but he doesn't address Ham, that son from the tent. Instead, Noah speaks to Ham's brothers, Shem and Japheth, and then Ham's son, Canaan. Look at Genesis 9, verses 25 through 27. He said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." Now, this kind of Hebrew poetry is called a heptastich. It's 7 lines of poetry. Let me arrange them for you on the screen so you see. "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." And so a pattern develops here. You see a section about Canaan, and you see a section about Shem, and you see a section about Japheth. And each line starts with a curse or a blessing about those men. And each of those sections ends with a statement about Canaan being a servant. But then what stands out is this extra line of poetry. It's out of place, and it's saying something unusual. Now, you don't want me to spend tons of time with grammatical explanations, so let me just make it as short as I can. A pronoun like he applies most naturally to the subject of the previous clause. In this case, the subject is God. God shall dwell in the tents of Shem. Again, even in the aftermath of sin, The promise of God is being traced. It's going forward. The promise of God started with the seed of the woman in Genesis 3:15, and then to Seth, and then down that lineage to Noah, and now it's going to Noah's son Shem. Now there's one more story in this downward spiral of sin in the first section of Genesis, and that's the account of the Tower of Babel. Again, the account seemed to mirror earlier stories, just like with creation and then the fall of Adam and Eve and then the failure of all the earth leading to the flood. What we have is the flood and then the failure of Noah's family and then the entirety of humanity still disobeying God. Here's God's command to humanity following the flood. God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." That is, spread out, fill the whole earth. Now, they didn't do it. Genesis 10, when you read it, it's called the Table of Nations, and it records 70 major families, but they're still traveling as one unit and one society. It's describing what will happen after the events of Genesis 11. Each of those families will be scattered, but not until the events of Genesis 11 sends them out. So instead of scattering, replenishing, filling the earth according to God's command, here's what they do. Genesis 11, verse 1 says, "The whole earth was of one language and of one speech." Verse 4 says, "They said, 'Go to, let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth.'" So humanity is determined to create a kingdom, not a kingdom under the authority of God, but one that's going to rise up above the authority of God. They've rejected every command, they've rebelled against his authority, and they want to elevate themselves instead. Now, the place this happens is interesting. Genesis 11, verse 2 tells us it's in the plain in the land of Shinar. It's what we call Mesopotamia, consisting mostly of the land between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. The tower is called Babel, but later in the Bible story, we find the city of Babylon there. You might just want to tuck that into the back of your head for a while. But God keeps his promise to Noah. He's not going to destroy the world in a flood. But he also is not going to allow the wickedness and rebellion at Babel to continue. And so he confounds their speech. Right? It's hard to build a tower when the engineer speaks Chaldean and the brickmaker speaks some Indo-European language and the guy with the hammer is talking in some pre-Asian dialect, right? They can't work together. Turns out they can't even live together. They spread out, which is what God had commanded them to do. As Moses begins this grand plan of redemption through Jesus Christ, as he's telling this story, what we've seen is the pervasiveness of sin. The earth is being populated by wicked creatures. We've got different families and different nations and different languages, but all of them are carrying with them the common problem of sin. The story has been set up now for the second part of Genesis. Starting in Genesis 12, something else is brewing over there in the land of Mesopotamia. Out of that area of Babel or Babylon, God is going to call an idol-worshipping pagan named Abram. We shouldn't be surprised to find that Abram is a descendant of Noah's son Shem. The promise of God is this unstoppable force. And God makes a covenant with Abram. He says, "I'll make you a great nation, and in you will all the families of the earth be blessed." So these self-exalting humans, God had stopped their rebellion by scattering them with the intention of gathering them back together on his own terms. Ultimately, the failure of the Tower of Babel is the success of God's plan. There can't be just one family. There can't be just one language. There can't be just one nation. That is not grand enough for what God has planned. So the failure of this kingdom-making plan at the Tower of Babel sets the stage for the coming kingdom of Jesus. By the time this grand story of redemption is done, the redeemed subjects of King Jesus are going to be singing to him in Revelation 5:9, "You have redeemed us to God by your blood, out of every kindred and language and people and nation." And so as God scatters them throughout the earth, it's with a plan to gather them back together under the headship and authority of King Jesus.